Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Kabuki Theatre. Following the rejection of Vladimir Putin's call to postpone a referendum by the pro-Russian secessionists, Putin claims not to control that his GRU and Spetsnaz have organized. Kevin Platt, a professor of Slavic studies at the University of Pennsylvania and author of History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution, joins us to discuss how Putin is playing the role of both the arsonist and the fire brigade while delaying sanctions and continuing to destabilize Ukraine. Then we'll speak with Mike Lofgren, a 28-year veteran House and Senate senior staffer who is the author of The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, and an important essay at BillMoyers.com, Anatomy of the Deep State. He joins us to discuss a whole new level of election year theater of the absurd with Thursday's resolution to establish a House Select Committee to investigate Benghazi for the fifth time and Wednesday's partisan vote by House Republicans to hold an IRS official in contempt for exercising her rights under the Fifth Amendment. Then finally, we will look into a revival of polio, a crippling disease that was all but eradicated due to a vaccine, but is now an epidemic the World Health Organization is declaring an international public health emergency. Seth Mnookin, the Associate Director of MIT's Graduate Program in Science Writing and author of The Panic Virus, The True Story Behind the Vaccine Autism Controversy, joins us to discuss how a bogus, discredited theory that vaccinating children causes autism has contributed to the revival of polio, measles, and whooping cough, and that the actress Jenny McCarthy and Oprah Winfrey, not to mention Pacifica Radio, should be held accountable for spreading irresponsible conspiracy theories. And joining us now is Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literature and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths, and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kevin Platt.
Thank you, Ian.
And Kevin, it looks as if there's a kind of kabuki theater going on here now with Russian President Vladimir Putin saying that he doesn't really have much influence over the pro-Russian separatists in the south and east of Ukraine, and that he doesn't think it's a good idea to go ahead with the referendum scheduled for this weekend. And lo and behold, the pro-Russian self-declared secessionists in the east and south of Ukraine have said they are going to go ahead, which, of course, reinforces Putin's point. At the same time, the places are awash with GRU and Spetsnaz people that Putin has put in there. So do you see this as sort of a cynical theater?
I don't, actually. I think that, you know, on the one hand, the place is certainly awash with all kinds of representatives of the Russian special forces who have been mobilizing and radicalizing the Russian-speaking, ethnic Russian-identified populations of the east of Ukraine. On the other hand, this is, as it has been christened by the media, hybrid warfare, which involves both operatives and representatives of the state under direct orders and local populations, which are mobilized to take actions on their own behalf. And I think it's undoubtable that the people that have been mobilized in the, you know, southeast of Ukraine in these pro-Russian secessionist movements definitely believe and are moved by a sincere passion to support the idea that their future lies with some kind of an independence or a full independence or autonomy or more probably precisely with Russia. Yet one has to keep in mind that I think the Kremlin's politics here are entirely cynical. I doubt that Putin wants as his end result of this entire undertaking in eastern Ukraine responsibility for eastern Ukraine to pay for its bills, to take it on board as a part of the Russian Empire. In this sense, his goals, I think, are, you know, far different from those of the people that he has mobilized on the ground. So that on the one hand, you know, about a week ago, everyone was opening their mouths in wonder at the, you know, amazing efficiency of the Russian strategy in eastern Ukraine to achieve all kinds of ends, which no one could have predicted a month ago. Whereas on the other hand, I think we're seeing here the weaknesses of this so-called hybrid warfare, that when people aren't under your command, they're going to do things that you didn't tell them to do, and perhaps which are directly contradictory to your strategies. I mean, in the end, Putin, I think, could care less for the actual population of eastern Ukraine. He does not have any interest in protecting the rights of Russians, ethnic Russians, from anything. He's interested in great power politics.
So then all of these talk about Novorossiya, new Russia, and taking back the USSR, and what a catastrophe it was to the collapse of the USSR, and the notion that he'd be interested in moving to protect the Russian minorities in the Baltics. You don't see that as a possibility.
Well, I think that it's a cynical piece of rhetoric that Putin has deployed in order to shake up the world order and to change the sort of the game with regard to Russia's ability to project power into Eastern Europe, into what Russia calls the near abroad, the sort of ring of states, former Soviet states, which surrounds Russia. It also relates to domestic politics. You know, Russia's approval rate, Putin's approval ratings following the 2011-2012 protest movement were falling. They hadn't fallen low by Western standards, but they had fallen low by Putin standards to 63% as of last spring. Now they're up at 80%. So one has to draw certain conclusions about the power and attractiveness of this conception of Russian victimhood, which is being corrected now by the move to reclaim a position of great power in the world among the Russian population. People are moved by this idea of Russian patriotism. And Putin has that, I think, as his ultimate goal. It's to secure his position in Russia. It's not to reconstruct some kind of an empire which he can't pay for anyway.
Again, I'm speaking with Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literature and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. So my understanding is that, just to buttress what you're saying, Kevin Platt, is that the Crimea is turning into a huge expanse and is likely to get even more expensive, since it depends upon electricity and water coming from Ukraine, and it's essentially landlocked, and they may have to build a bridge, you know, hugely expensive undertaking. So that certainly appears to be the case. So what is he doing? Because I've understood that he really doesn't want this election to take place.
Absolutely.
Which he's now said he does. I'm talking about the May the 25th election in Ukraine itself, not the referendum called by the secessionists in the East.
Well, I mean, it seems to me that the end goal in Ukraine is clearly to destabilize that state to the extent that Putin and his proxies in the East can generate a new structure for Ukraine, which would prevent it from ever acceding to EU in any serious way, or ever becoming a NATO member state in any serious way, so that the immediate goal is to disrupt the political processes in Ukraine to the extent that, and to encourage the continuing street fighting and separatist activities in the East to the extent that will be necessary in order to, in the end, somehow, either in concert with Western powers or on his own, appear on the white horse, probably in his case, on the diplomatic white horse, dictating terms of some kind of a new settlement in terms of the political structure of Ukraine, which would allow autonomies in the East, special protections for ethnic Russians, and also special veto powers over legislation and actions taken by the center. This is the federalization of Ukraine that Putin keeps on bringing up in his speeches. With regard to the elections which are coming up, I'm certain that he wants to sort of walk this fine line to, on the one hand, allow Ukraine to persist as a state and not fall apart entirely, because then he ends up, you know, holding the bag and having to figure out what to do with Ukraine's East. At the same time, destabilizing the situation to the extent that he can always cast aspersions upon the legitimacy of that vote. The proposal that he was trying to push earlier this week was that there would be a dual vote, that certain elements of referenda concerning autonomy, independence, and so on, would be wrapped into the initial vote regarding presidents in Kiev. It seems like he's backed off on that idea, but I think the plan is to continue destabilizing the situation, casting aspersions on all of the initiatives which emanate from Kiev until he can get his way.
So he's sort of being both the arsonist and the fire brigade, right?
Absolutely. That's the role that he wants to take. He wants to, you know, control the situation. Mm-hmm. And so far, it seems like he's doing it in a fairly effective way, one has to say. It's incredibly, I think, disturbing for Western heads of state and for Western strategic thinkers to look at this situation and realize that there is, you know, very little that they can do. I think that on the diplomatic front, the effort has to be to try and engage Putin and to, you know, present him with the risk of, on the one hand, total isolation from the West, and on the other hand, economic and military expenses that he's not prepared to make. Putin seems to have become aware of that in the course of the last week and a half, and I think that's what's dictating his actions earlier this week when he backed off on his support for the secessionist movement.
Well, but if he can manipulate things and destabilize this place and basically say to the West, well, if you want to step in and take care of this basket case, you can, but keep it on a low boil, you know, obviously he's playing a game to avoid more sanctions. And this is, I think, what's behind his magnanimous gestures.
Oh, I agree. You know? I agree 100%. But of course, he also doesn't want to create a situation in which the situation spirals so far out of control that the only possible action would be peacekeeping forces there, which would inevitably involve also Western peacekeeping forces.
Right. So, well, but I think in terms of blowback to him, you've mentioned how we've already talked about how he's saddled with Crimea now, which is a big expense. But mm-hmm. taking on all of the eastern Ukraine would be even infinitely greater expense.
Absolutely. Although there are certain advantages there, too, that others have pointed out. I mean, one of the reasons that he wants to keep a hold on the sort of client relationships that tie eastern Ukraine to Russia is because there are a variety of important industries that do a lot of business with Russia located there, including business which is strategically important to him for military industrial kinds of projects. So he's got a very sort of delicate balancing act that he has to pursue if he wants to get his end result, which is a state which is still caught between, in which there is no possibility of a decisive action with regard to alignment with Europe in Kiev, and in which he can still more or less control without having the responsibility for parts of eastern Ukraine. That's the end goal that he has in mind. Crimea is going to be incredibly expensive, and incredibly expensive in Russian terms is always 10 times more expensive, as we know from the Olympics, than it would be in any normal society, just because building a bridge is going to cost not only the actual cost of building the bridge, but the cost of lining the pockets of everyone who's involved building the bridge. Building water treatment plants, the same thing. So from what we can hear about what's going on in Crimea, it seems like the sort of inevitable chaos of transforming an entire region from one economic system to another, from one currency to another, from one water supply to another, and from one economic, you know, structure to another in the course of a, you know, fortnight is coming to roost. It's a impossibly chaotic situation there. Everyone is worried about their savings. None of the banks are working. No one knows what to do with their money. It's a mess.
And this was only, what, a few months ago, they were celebrating that their standard of living was going to go up.
Yeah, it's incredibly ironic and sad, I think, for the populations who are in the firing line. Ukraine had its problems, and I think the people that went out on Maidan, they were, of course, moved by the inactivity of the Yanukovych government with regard to the EU cooperation treaty, but I think they were even more moved, many of them, simply by the inefficiency and corruption of Ukraine's successive governments, whether they've been Western-aligned or Russian-aligned. They had their problems, but still, it was a functioning society. And it was also a society in which ethnic Russians and Ukrainians largely lived side by side peaceably. This whole idea of Ukraine as a divided state where there are clear and sharp divisions between a pro-Russian and a pro-Ukrainian side is really not a good representation of this society. It's a society in which there's a a large middle in which there is a intermingling of these two cultures and societies and languages, those people are not being represented at all by this polarized conflict.
But it seems in terms, the other aspect of blowback in terms of what Putin has unleashed and what he may reap, and that is, you know, I mean, first of all, I think the EU was pretty boneheaded in making this offer zero sum situation, and then Putin turned around and made it a zero sum situation by saying to Yanukovych, you know, you got to be with us, and it's either us or them, and it has to be us. And, you know, you keep hearing from the Russians about the encroachment of NATO heading east, which it never made a lot of sense, frankly. But he has convinced the Russian people, and they seem pretty well convinced that NATO is this malignant force that's trying to encroach on their sovereignty, when it's, in fact, a shell. There's nothing there. I don't think there's even any tanks in Europe at all. And isn't it possible that now NATO and the new members of NATO will in fact increase their military budgets, that Putin may actually end up creating his own nemesis?
Absolutely. I think it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, although I'm not certain that it's Putin's nemesis. I think if we think once again about Putin's situation in his domestic political scene, he is a man with very few options. There's no possibility for him to leave office in Russia. And I think he realized that some time ago, that considering the scale of the corruption and wrongdoing which has taken place under his watch, there's no one that he can trust to look out for his interests should he eventually decide to step down, which means that he needs to always develop strategies to remain in power. The sort of drop in his popularity, the rise of a seemingly well-supported, at least in the cities, protest movement, the rise of political rivals such as Navalny on the horizon, all of that made him exceedingly nervous in the past 2 years. What did he do? He developed a strategy which would allow him to create a patriotic frenzy within Russia, which has allowed him, one, to raise his approval ratings in the short term, but two, to implement all kinds of extraordinarily restrictive media and social policy, which will allow him to maintain control as long as he wants, right? With the result of the legislative procedures which have taken place, the legislative maneuvers which have taken place over the past year, and especially in the past several months, he has asserted, you know, really serious control over the internet, over the media, and over, therefore, the public opinion of his subject population in Russia. That's, I think, the key to his strategy. Creating a situation where he's confronting the West, so much the better in a certain sense for him, right? It mm-hmm. increases his possibility to peddle this idea of hostile encirclement, which threatens the Russian way of life.
Sure.
So I don't think he's that worried about NATO beefing up its presence in Europe. The idea that NATO would invade him, that's, of course, crazy. No one is ever going to, you know, encroach on Russian space.
Right. Well,
back to the question of NATO expansion in the first place. If I can touch on that briefly.
Very briefly, yeah.
I think that, as well as the question of EU accession for Ukraine, and much else which has gone on in the past several years, has been, or over the past decade, you know, the NATO expansion began to take place at the end of the 90s, is indicative of a certain inability of Western actors to let go of a Cold War mentality with regard to Russia. And, of course, there is some justification in, you know, treating Russia as a, you know, not completely European society with incomplete and now dismantled civic institutions, civil society structures. Yet, I think it was a strategic error on the part of Western actors to treat Eastern Europe or the relationship with Russia as anything like a zero-sum game. The story and the approach should always have been Europe is an open society with open arms, which is ready to cooperate with Russia, and which is ready to cooperate with zones like Ukraine, which are between Russia and Europe as equal partners with Russia. It should never have been our economic zone or your economic zone.
Well, Kevin,
and I think is a major strategic error that we are now reaping the results of.
Well, Kevin Platt, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Kevin Platt, who's a professor of Slavic languages and literature and graduate chair of the Comparative Literature Program at the University of Pennsylvania. His books include Terror and Greatness, Ivan and Peter as Russian Myths and History in a Grotesque Key, Russian Literature and the Idea of Revolution. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into this year's election year, Theater of the Absurd by the House Republicans.